The Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Education is Thursday, March 1st, 2007, 3 p.m. in Hearing Room F.
Thursday, March 1st, 2007, the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education Subcommittee, and we're going to continue with Senate Bill 5529, Oregon Health and Science University, a public hearing. And before I call up Dr. Halleck, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Bender, who's going to discuss the materials that we have sitting in front of us. So, Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. Under your agenda for today, you should have a set of three materials, and I just wanted to let you know what these are. There's also an additional material that OHSU brought out, which is a PowerPoint slide. But these, first of all, I'll start with these first three. The first of these is a priority list, the department-wide priorities for the governor's recommended budget. This is a standard form which you'll be seeing for all of your budgets, which lists the various programs in the agency's priority order. If you look at this closely, you'll see that in the second column there, they're numbered sequentially. One through six represent the existing base budget programs of OHSU. And then beginning through 7 through on the back page, you have on the other side of the page, through 14 are the policy option packages in the order that the agency has prioritized them. So, for example, row 7, the highest priority policy option package, and from the agency's point of view, is one that you haven't heard yet, but that you'll be hearing about today for the Area Health Education Centers program. So I wanted to let you know that this was available. My suggestion to you is if you want to put this into the agency presentation binder book, you might want to do that before tab 1, because if you look before tab 1, right behind the table of contents, you should find in there already a 2% reduction scenario table. And the 2% reduction scenario table is another form that is being presented by agencies, all agencies. In this particular case, you can see it lists the total amount of 2% of their budget, which is about $1.5 million. And this is their recommendation if you were to take 2% out of their budget to meet the co-chair's directive. These show, or the suggestions of where they think it would be optimal to take those out given that constraint. It also lists some of the policy option packages. You can see right here what they are and the various costs for the various things that they're doing. But I would suggest putting this list, you know, right here by this other one so you can see the policy option packages in the priority order next to the 2% reduction. The other two items are on a tan sheet of paper. This is another common sheet that you'll be seeing for all of the agencies that I'm staffing for you, and it is a review of whether the agency complied with the budget notes and directives that were approved last session, in the 2005 session. You will probably approve budget notes and certainly approve budget directives for agencies this time around, and the idea will be in 2 years, you know, you check to see whether they've complied. There was actually only one budget note for OHSU last session, but it was quite lengthy, so I sort of parsed it into four components here. And our determination is that the agency did comply with what you directed them to do in all respects last session. I don't want to spend a lot of time here right now unless you want to, but basically, A, the first item of the budget note says that they were supposed to fund the various programs at the 2003-05 levels. The governor had cut funding, the legislature restored it, and they were directed to fund those programs at the prior biennium levels. And they did that. B said that not only were they supposed to fund at the prior levels, they were supposed to maintain program services at the prior levels. And they did do that as well. And you can see I've got some specifics there. Nursing enrollments have increased. Medicine and dental enrollments are above the 2003-05 biennium level. And non-residential tuition rate differentials were maintained. Those were three things that OHSU was directed to do. C talks about the programs outside of the three schools, CDRC, Poison Control Center, Area Health Education Centers. It talks about maintaining those services. the agency did comply with that. And finally, D was directed that they should continue to serve Medicaid and uninsured low-income patients. And they have complied with that. The proportion of their patients on Medicaid has declined, but that is what they indicated would be likely to happen given that their hospital support was cut last biennium. And finally, I've included an item which is a report from the Employment Department. These are excerpts from a report, Oregon Healthcare Workforce Needs Assessment. I thought this might be interesting to you because it is a report that the Employment Department does of whether what the future demand will be for particular professions. And the OHSU policy option packages, to a large extent, increase the output of the medical schools and of the nursing schools in terms of degrees. And if you look at the Employment Department report here, on page 38, speaking of physicians and surgeons, where I started there in the middle, they have estimated, the Employment Department calculates, that we should have 193 MDs. We need 193 MDs per year on average per year over the next 10 years. And that there is a gap, that we have a shortfall of 88 given OHSU's at that time completion rate of 105 students, MD student degrees per year. So you will see that OHSU does have policy option packages to increase their output from 105 to 160 per year. And according to this is consistent with state needs. On the next sheet, on page 42, this is their similar analysis for nursing. I really like this table 29 because it sort of shows all the state's nursing programs on one page, which I've never seen anything that was this clear before that does that. But you can see where nursing degrees are currently being awarded. And if you look in the middle again, I started with a three-hole punch, kind of punched out the star. It says here that the estimated gap in nursing is that we need about 111 more nursing degrees each year than we now have. Now this is curious because if you skip to the bottom, it says pipeline, you'll see that they're saying that there are already about 180 degree expansions in the pipeline already. That Oregon Coast is going to add 20, that George Fox is going to add 40, and that Mount Hood is going to expand from 40 to 160, so that's an extra 120. Given these numbers, it would appear that there will not be a shortage of nursing degrees. I mean, clearly OHSU believes that there is, and I think this will be an issue that when we get into work session, you'll want to look into further, and I'll look into further to be able to give you additional background on this.
Thank you very much, Steve. All right, now I'd like to call up Dr. Leslie Halleck, who's been serving as provost and here as master of ceremonies. And so I think I'll just turn it over to you. And
Chairman DeLizio, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm provost at Oregon Health and Science University, and I have with me several colleagues, just so you know where we're headed. We're in the middle of tab two, right after the second yellow page. That's where we left off Tuesday, so about halfway through tab two, more than halfway. Right after the second yellow page is where the School of Medicine program begins, and you will hear now from the School of Medicine Dean, Mark Richardson. Mark and Lisa up here. And following that, you will hear from the director of the AHEC, or Area Health Education Center program, Lisa Dodson. So we'll go through those, and then once we finish those two programs, I will discuss a few things that we haven't yet been covered, the Office of Rural Health and some of the pipeline programs, very briefly, and give you a very brief summary. And I'll address, there's a little slide packet in front of you that pulls some of the slides. There's just a few that you've already seen, but this way you won't have to fish through your books to find them. And then Dr. Robertson will conclude. So that's where we're headed today. And it's page 35 of the third section in your book, if that helps. It's right after the second yellow page. That's where we are. And with that, I'll turn the program over to Mark Richardson. You have to say your name, Mark.
I'm Chairman Glizio, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richardson. I'm a relative newcomer to Oregon. I moved here 6 years ago to lead a department at OHSU.
During that period of time, we've recruited approximately 10 new faculty in my department. All of their pre-docs, post-docs, laboratory assistants. My two older girls now live in Portland and work. Taxpayers, I want you to know. And I want to thank you for the Oregon opportunity that you provided to us and that we received. Let's get into some additional performance measures. Over the past 10 years, U.S. News and World Report has obviously recognized OHSU as being a leader in primary care and in family care. Consistently, we've always ranked in the top 10 and continue to do so. We also attract a wide number of applicants for our relatively few positions within the medical school, and our pediatrics program and internal medicine program are widely sought after by a number of resident applicants throughout the country. We also have a very highly desirable product in that our graduates match very well each year as they go off to seek additional training and specialty education. This past year, U.S. News and World Report has again re-endorsed their previous ratings, showing extremely high rankings in primary care, rural medicine, and family medicine. But additionally, another statistic I think that is extremely important to recognize is that over the past 10 years, since 1998, we went from being recognized as in a bottom tier of research universities where we weren't measured, they really don't measure below 50, to now 32nd in the country as a research organization. And the departments here that you can see on the slide, neurosciences, anesthesia, my own department, otolaryngology, all rank in the top 5, and we now have, I think, at least 12 departments that are ranked in the top 25 for research dollars in the U.S. at this point. That is in spite of these statistics, which I think are also important to recognize, in that we are not well publicly supported, at least in terms of dollars, as it relates to Western medical schools. Our tuition is, as listed here, it's relatively high, but far from the highest in the country. Out-of-state tuition at the University of Colorado is now at $83,000, certainly at Georgetown and other private universities on the East Coast, they are in the 50 to 60 thousands for, again, out-of-state tuitions. Our in-state tuition is a little bit higher than average. It is somewhere around the 60th to 70th percentile, so we're a little bit high. But again, we have maintained, I think, our class size pretty well despite the diminishment in state funding that we've received. This, I think, is a pretty good slide to look at because it represents Western publicly assisted medical schools and where we rank in terms of state allocation dollars and where we rank in terms of research dollars brought in. So I think it's a good reflection of what we've been able to do with the money that you have invested in our medical school. Our applicants continue to increase, and this is in spite of overall a diminishing number of applicants to medical schools in the U.S. So we aren't taking advantage of greater numbers everywhere. We have a well-recognized medical school for its excellence in teaching, research, and all of the other benefits of living in Oregon, and now even riding on the tram. We have...
Excuse me, Dr. Richardson?
Yes, Chairman Bozier.
I'm sorry, just going back to the comparison, the Western publicly assisted...
Yes, sir.
In terms of the state allocation for student, I'm trying to understand how, for example, UC San Francisco, what are you counting as allocation? Because $196,000 per student compared to $23,000 is extraordinary.
It is.
So...
Those dollars, if you took the amount of allocated dollars from the state to UCSF mm-hmm. and divided it by student, that's what you'd get.
So, in terms of, and I'm just trying to understand allocated where. In other words, it just seems like that's so incongruous that what are you counting as the allocation? I mean, in other words, do you see what I'm saying?
It's our school of medicine budget. So the dollars that were allocated to the school of medicine are those figures.
Okay. Senator Devlin?
I think part of the question the chair is asking, if I'm understanding it, obviously there's the vast difference. But if you're educating, and I think there's other things here in terms of your research and federal dollars that actually goes into your process of educating students, and I think that's what we're getting to. But if our total amount in terms of state support, tuition revenues and state support is this amount, and their amount is this, and actually I have to look at the number of students also.
Right.
Let's take one of them pretty easily. Also have to meet ADA requirements in an older age.
That's 602. Yes, 602.
Okay. They have 602, 480 for us at the top of scale. Their total cost is in the neighborhood of $130 million for those 602. Our total cost, if we're just counting those two left, is about 20,
right.
21.
Right.
Now, is it vastly more expensive to educate medical students in San Francisco, or is the money actually going to some other use than just educating the students, or what explains for them this difference?
You have the best bargain on the West Coast. It is, of course, UCSF is part of a larger medical school consortium, but those are the actual dollars, if you look across here, I mean, it is a startling statistic, but those are the real numbers.
May I take a crack at this?
I
think one of the things that I believe your question is taking us is that the total cost of educating the students is far greater, of course, than $23,000. And at OHSU, the rest of that cost is covered both by tuition but also by contributions from the clinical enterprise. In the case of UCSF, probably the full cost is covered by the state. In addition, there's probably investment in things like the rest of the mission of that school.
Research infrastructure, faculty recruitment.
Here's another way of looking at that, Jim Galizia and committee. One thing that UCSF has as being a sort of state institution governed by a board of regents is that they have a guaranteed sort of tenure slot that is given to professors or associate professors within the School of Medicine. There's actually a guaranteed source of dollars for their salary. That really doesn't happen at this point in reality to OHSU. That certainly would account for some of the dollar differential that you're seeing there. And I think that's what Leslie was getting at.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see an entirely different message in this chart. It's the Oregon Initiative effect. And I would guess that if you reproduce this, instead of for the year 2005, you went back 15 years or 18 years prior to 1999, you would see an entirely different distribution of dollars.
Chairman Galizia and Senator Morris, you're absolutely right. We weren't at the bottom then. And there definitely has been some rearranging. And I think we were next to the bottom last year, but it has been a march really since Measure 5 has passed.
Thank you.
So if we look at what's happening in terms of Oregon residents applying to medical school, the numbers did sort of reach a nadir in 2000, but are now increasing. And our acceptance rate for Oregon medical students is also increasing. Our strategies and initiatives to increase diversity at the medical school are moving along, and I think we are doing our best in terms of both mentoring new faculty. We are providing annual orientation for new faculty in terms of diversity, and we are actively utilizing diversity training in our recruitment processes. We have, in fact, received a HCOP grant from Health Resources and Services Administration of the federal government to try and provide additional educational experiences to individuals in the pipeline who might be interested in medical school or medical careers to try and prepare them for medical school entry. We also use that for other medical careers, including the physician assistant program and the pharmacy. Unfortunately, this is a program that was discontinued by the federal government in 2006, but one that we are continuing to try and find funding for this year. As you've heard, I think there is a physician workforce crisis, and I think we can all argue about the actual numbers, but as you heard at the preface to our interaction there, by the Oregon Workforce Commission, there is a gap between our production of physicians and what our actual need is. What's happened over the past 20 years is that there really has not been a significant increase in the number of physicians being trained, and as a result of just increasing population growth, we are not meeting the demand that is likely to be necessary, especially in the face of an aging population. If you look at what has happened to physician age distribution over the past 20 years, this graph is fairly representative. And if you look at ages 45 to 54, 55 through 64, and 65 and over, you'll see that about two-thirds of our physician population will be retiring within the next 20 years at the time when our population demand for medical care is going to be likely at its highest. This is also just specific to Oregon, and it does very much parallel the national experience additionally. A survey that was performed indicated, at least in Oregon, that over a two-year period of time, there were going to be 1,200 physicians leaving the workplace. That's out of a total population of about 10,000 physicians in our state. Through retirement, leaving, career change, or temporary leaves of absence. Senator Devlin.
I just had a general question about your graphs in terms of age of physicians. Has there been any work done in terms of changes in terms of life patterns for physicians? I just think of it in the sense of one of my spouse's physicians retired, I believe, last year, and they were close to probably close to 68, 69. One of my physicians is still working. He's nowhere close to that age, but I expect he always talks about there's an old school and a new school, and I think he'll probably keep working the same kind of hours he's working until he's 65 or 70. But I tend to see more physicians actually leaving practice a lot earlier than they normally would have left practice. Some physicians, because of changes in expectations and changes in terms of people's desires, that choose to practice part-time versus practicing full-time. There have been any studies done in that area, because I do think that I sometimes run into these physicians that are still going to hospital rounds early in the morning and at night, and they're in their 60s, and they commonly lament to me that they're a dying breed.
Chair Galizio and committee members, and Senator Devlin, that's an excellent point. There have been a number of studies, actually, from the American Association of Medical Colleges looking at average retirement age for physicians. It is diminishing every year. Right now, I think, if I remember correctly, the last statistic was an age of 62.7 years. But if you look at the trend line, it is diminishing on a yearly basis. basis. An important question in that survey that was performed by the AAMC was, if you could retire now, would you? Of course, everybody answered yes to that question. What would, you know, it's interesting that the primary imperative is, as you mentioned, to a certain extent, lifestyle. For those physicians, they really feel like they need to make enough money to retire, but once they do, they will exit the workforce. If you look at our younger workforce, and that, I'm talking about that older range of physician, if you look at our younger workforce, and you can, they're right, there is a difference between, I think, physicians trained 20 years ago and those that are being trained currently or over the past 10 years. It really is about lifestyle, controlling their hours, and it is different. I don't think there's been enough evidence so far to indicate how much of a diminished productivity there might be as a result of that, though.
What positions does he have? Probably a cause of the shortage.
Well, let's say we could get to Representative Jensen over there before I run out.
Great. So we do have a plan to try and meet some of those workforce demands. And in fact, we did increase our entering medical school class to 120 from 110 over this past year. And of course, I hope that you all are aware of our plan to increase the size of our medical school to a larger number yet, 160, by expanding training and education sites to Eugene and Corvallis for our first year in medical school. All of the second year, yes,
I'm sorry, Chairman? Representative Jensen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm kind of looking at your graphs and data here, and it's bringing a question. As to the number of foreign students who are in our medical schools, not only here in the state of Oregon, but in the country, in the United States or in Western United States, wherever data might be available for that, and as compared and contrasted with, say, you're showing us one chart on the, with 1982 physician age as compared to what one might have found in the United States in 1982 or some period, you know, back there. Do you have any data like that?
Actually, Representative Jensen, that's an excellent question and a great observation. What happened is the federal, when we looked at overall physician supply in the mid-80s, one of the strategies by the federal government was actually to allow for an increased influx of foreign physicians to our workforce. That's changed, and the federal government actually has made it now much more difficult for foreign medical graduates to come in and provide care in the United States. That then, in turn, has resulted in some of the workforce shortage that we're predicting now.
And that was what I thought I was seeing, but I'm glad you had.
Yes, sir. That's exactly correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah. So, what are we going to do, and how are we going to try and do this? Well, obviously, we want to increase the class size in Portland, but at this particular point in time, our facilities are strapped at the 120 level. That's why our regionalization plan to accept additional medical students through our university partners in Corvallis and Eugene seems to be a great strategy to increase the number of medical school matriculants and solve some of our difficulties here. We will have clinical sites throughout the state. So in addition to Salem and Eugene, we have partners in Bend and Medford and Ashland as well. Klamath Falls as well. So we do have opportunities not only for our first 2 years of education for our medical students, but a clinical activity where they can actually go be in hospitals in their second 2 years of medical school. And you probably know where those tuition or where those initiatives are in the governor's budget. I'm going to let Lisa, who's actually in charge of the AHEC program, talk a little bit about the Rural Scholars Program.
Representative Glizzy, everybody's gone. Committee, I'm Lisa Dodson. I'm the director of the Oregon Area Health Education Centers Program and a family physician at Oregon Health Sciences University. My background in practice was in John Day, Oregon, prior to coming to OHSU, so I have extensive interest in and practice experience with rural populations. The main point of this slide was not to provide a lot of information, but to make a point that the Oregon Rural Scholars Program was actually preceded, the discussion about that preceded the development of these regionalization initiatives. And this has been a program we've been sort of dying to get going for a number of years now. Because it came first, a lot of people heard that name and have been confused about what the regionalization initiative is. And I wanted to just make a point that this is a separate, this is a small piece of the regionalization initiative. Most of the regionalization will not be a rural program. Eugene is clearly not a rural area, at least by comparison with John Day. So the Rural Scholars Program will admit students specifically in a small subset of that expansion, but it is not the whole program. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear, since some people were confused about what the terminology was meaning there.
You can just keep going.
Okay. I think many of you have seen variations of this, and the darkly shaded areas are the frontier counties in Oregon, population less than 6 per square mile, and the colored areas are the urbanized areas. As obviously is probably clear to everyone, rural population is small, but the area is very large and underpopulated with physicians. Did you want to go on from there?
One of the reasons that we are so interested in our rural education programs and the AHEC program is because of not only the physician shortage, but the distribution issues, especially in Oregon. We feel that the regionalization program has, along with our other programs, a higher chance of getting our physicians out to the neediest areas in Oregon, where healthcare workers really are underrepresented. So our strategy is if we can put our physicians out in communities outside of just a solitary training site, they're much more likely to become integrated into that community and end up staying there in the long term.
Thank you, Leslie.
The AHEC program has been around in Oregon since the late 1980s. It was a grassroots campaign largely by the Eastern Oregon physician community, looking around and saying there's nobody coming to replace us. That was occurring at the time when OHSU's medical school class size and dental school class size were actually downsized in that same era, and it mirrored national data that showed that young physicians were increasingly less likely to enter rural practice. Since instituting the AHEC center, which began rolling in one at a time over a five-year period in the early 1990s, we provided rural training experiences to essentially 100% of our medical students, approximately 1,200 to date. We have trained 162 family physicians at two sites, both here at Portland, in Portland at the medical school campus, as well as starting a new residency focused on rural care in Klamath Falls, our Cascade East residency program. We also do a lot of other things besides medical school education. AHEC centers around the country are all quite different from one another, but in our center we have really focused a lot on rural allied health as well. NEO-AHEC, which is Northeast Oregon AHEC based in La Grande at Eastern Oregon University, has trained 1,744 rural emergency technicians. Most of these are volunteers in that area. Many of them are paying out of pocket for their own expenses, including training and equipment. And so we have provided a great deal of support for those personnel in order to allow them to train in their home communities, because travel for them as volunteers is extremely expensive and difficult. We have done a great deal with continuing education for physicians, nurses, and other allied health professionals, and we provide a great deal of education. Obviously, education is in our name. funding to health professionals, but we are also very concerned about the pipeline issue. Dean Richardson showed you a slide showing the number of Oregon applicants, and I don't know if it went through kind of quickly whether you caught the numbers, but out of our 4,000 applicants to our medical school, only 400 of those are from Oregon. We are very concerned that we produce enough quality graduates from our state university system to meet the needs of Oregonians, and that's one of AHEC's focuses, is to make sure that rural students, students of color, other underserved students are receiving education that allows them to be competitive in that environment. And we do provide education at 112 high schools and over 8,000 student contacts over the last year. These are our AHEC centers. Maps on the detail, there are little red dots that sort of show where we have sorted AHEC activities. Some of those are recruitment sites. We partner with the Office of Rural Health, who provides the HERO program for recruitment, and then teaching sites and training sites, as well as technical assistance combined through the AHEC and the Office of Rural Health. This is an important slide that dates back for a couple of decades, so I just wanted to point out this little white dot in the right lower corner where 1% of people receive their care represents the academic medical center where almost all of us received our medical education. The goal of an AHEC program is to push the students out as far to the left and up as we can in this diagram. We believe that if we train students out in one of these boxes beyond the medical school, they A, get a good education, they B, are more likely to choose to serve underserved populations and to distribute properly so that the entire needs of the state are met. I don't think I probably have to tell any of you that in rural Oregon and rural countries or rural counties in general, healthcare is really economic development. The hospital is often, if not the largest employer, it is certainly one of the largest and may have the most diverse workforce of any of the agencies in rural counties. The only other competitor is often the school districts. It is really important to note the economic impact, obviously, of having a physician. These are just some nationwide statistics. Unfortunately, we don't have anything Oregon-specific, but this is from the national data. One rural physician can create up to 17 jobs directly and indirectly into the economy and add anywhere between $500,000 and $2 million to the local economy due to the services that are provided, particularly if they are providing hospital-based services as well as clinic services. A rural doctor, nurse, or dentist, any healthcare professional adds $1.50 to the economy for each dollar that they earn. This is a report that I just wanted to comment on briefly that I would love to reproduce in Oregon. Unfortunately, we have not yet, until recently, had the infrastructure to do so. This is based out of the Oklahoma 25-year commission report on the Manpower Training Act that was enacted there in the 1970s when Oklahoma realized they were having a tremendous shortage already. The state has invested $100 million in additional education costs at training health professionals, and they have invested $18 million over that 25-year period in scholarship money. In addition to that, an additional $11 million in administrative costs to administer the program. So for a rough investment of $130 million, their estimates are that they have returned $3.6 billion to their state economy, of which $2.7 has remained in rural areas that are most in need. An argument could be made that some of that was going to happen anyway, and so an adjustment was made that said even if only 15% of the effect was actually an effect of the program, they still would have returned $445 million on a $130 million investment through this program. We don't have similar data for Oregon. I would love to have it. The family medicine residencies in Oregon, just a couple of points about this. Family medicine doctors are the most likely to distribute to rural areas. That is largely a breadth of practice issue. You can't have a pulmonologist in a town of 1,000 people. So our family practice residency programs, both in Portland and Klamath Falls, have been very active at producing rural physicians. And we've been far more successful in Portland than would be predicted from our demographic, being in the middle of a large city. Our graduates in rural practice on the bottom line, that's a key number for that particular residency. Out of 288, 106 are practicing in communities of less than 25,000 people. Mm-hmm. Not all in Oregon. Our Cascade East residency has done even better. On the bottom line, again, 47 out of 54 of their graduates, they've been around a much shorter period of time, and they have a much higher percentage, but they are particularly focused on attracting students and residents that are really interested. And these are just, again, data on primary care numbers from OHSU. The bars basically represent actually a trend that is fighting what is going on nationally. And what we are seeing in nationwide pools of medical students is a decreasing interest in primary care. This is really intended to kind of show you that OHSU has remained a popular place for training. Students come here because they want to engage in primary care training, both in internal medicine, pediatrics, and family medicine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnard,
thank you. Would you unpack the acronyms for us?
I'm sorry.
That's the one.
Oh, IM is internal medicine.
Right, and then on the next slide, there's several more acronyms.
I'm sorry, family medicine, internal medicine, and pediatrics.
Thank you.
Those are considered the three primary care specialties, and most some people add obstetrics and gynecology in, but most rural areas cannot support a full-time obstetrician because of the demographics.
Representative Barnhart has been so immersed in tax credits, RETC, and PETC.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate it.
I believe you're referring to the business energy tax credit and the residential energy tax
credit. Medicine is a very jargony profession, and I apologize.
So we are too, and there's an attempt to try to minimize that, so I appreciate it. Representative Barnhart, thank you.
Well, I ask when I don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
I don't ask just gratuitously, but I do appreciate the explanation.
Thank you. This is, again, nationwide data, which really, there's a very flat interest in primary care to a declining interest. And this is in the face of increasing numbers of medical students across the country. Many other medical schools are engaged in the same processes. So the main point I'd like to make is that we are really fighting a national trend, and we are doing a good job of promoting the things that are going to be most helpful at community-based practice in spite of trends that would argue that we couldn't do that easily. We are also very proud of our community partners and preceptors in this. We have 58 currently active AHEC faculty around the state in some of the smallest communities, from Cottage Grove to John Day, Burns, Lakeview, Reedsport, all around the state. 30 of our 58 are actually OHSU graduates, either of our residency programs or our medical school programs, with graduation dates ranging from 1972 to 2002. 2002 graduates are about the newest pool that are actually out in practice because of their residency requirements. 75% of our preceptors actually had an AHEC experience, and anecdotally tell us that that is the reason that they are participating in the program, is that it's the give back and the to the next generation that they're enjoying. We have 26 community sites around the state, and we have 18 of those sites have an OHSU graduate in them. We have looked back at data the best that we can accumulate prior to the AHEC program, and would have found a substantially smaller number of OHSU graduates in small communities prior to the AHEC program. What we need is really a better long-term tracking mechanism. One of the problems for us is that it takes a very long time to become a health professional. From high school graduation, it is an 11-year process at minimum to become a physician, 8 years for a dentist, 6 years for a PA, and 3 years for a nurse. So our program now, in its 15th year, is just really seeing the fruits of what we began doing quite a number of years ago. It makes it hard to make a case over the long term when you're focused, obviously, on immediate budget situations, but we do believe that we're seeing an impact and will be increasingly able to demonstrate that to you over the years. We do believe also that we have good data that says that our effects are also on retention of physicians. Our preceptors on average appear to be happier with their practices and stay longer in their practices in our rural communities. We believe that at least part of that is the intellectual challenge and stimulation they get from having students in their practice, as well as their connection to OHSU through technologies and other things that we can provide to them as our adjunct faculty. Other things we're looking for are really the markers of our good partnerships. I think one of the hallmarks of AHEC that I'm most proud of is our ability to partner with so many different kinds of agencies and groups. It's difficult to come up with markers that prove that or demonstrate that other than to give you long lists of who our partners are. But we believe that we add a lot of value to our partnerships, both in terms of the students that we provide and the resources that we bring, and we bring a lot of synergy. We don't right now have really good ways to show you that, like I said, other than just long lists of the people we partner with, and which I'm not going to bore you with, but we are looking for ways to demonstrate that because we really do believe that we add extra value. And then economic development, as I mentioned, I would really like to be looking at measures that look at the long-term effects of economic development on our rural communities particularly. Regarding our budget requests, most of the requests that we have made is to restore staffing losses over the past several years. Federal AHEC dollars have been diminishing, as have state dollars, and it has led to a loss of key personnel. We have essentially half of the staff that we had 10 years ago when you consider our four centers in the rural areas and our staff at the program office at OHSU. I should mention, just in case you weren't aware of that, we have centers in four of our rural communities, LeBrand, Bend, and Linden City, and down at Winston, which is near Roseburg. Those are where our four centers are. And in order to sustain programs, we made a decision as an institution to really cut budgets of staffing in order to provide that. We've really kind of reached the bottom of our ability to do that, and our next goal is to restore staffing so that we can begin reinflating programs as well. The programs that are in more or less order of importance here, K-12 pipeline, as I mentioned, our rural schools are really suffering in some ways. I think students coming out of rural schools are at slight disadvantage when they hit college, and we are looking for ways to promote science and math readiness for college students so that they are competitive and can enter the health careers directly without a lot of remediation. We are looking for college support activities through the professional advising system at the state university system. We have partnered with them to help identify students early in their college career who are health career bound. We are working with healthcare diversity issues, the medical school class size expansion, as I mentioned. The rural clerkship, the most expensive thing for us is housing the students. We have, if you can sort of think about the cost of housing, 120 and then going to 160 people for an entire year, the costs are going up dramatically, which is giving all of my directors palpitations. So we're looking for ways to support those activities with other community partners as well. Primarily, we're going to promote the clinical placement of all of our schools, including the School of Dentistry. We now have a pilot program going on this year to place dental students in rural communities for the first time. The nursing school has actually been doing this for a long time, but we are looking at ways to partner to reduce some of the costs associated with these placements and see if we can find some more efficiencies with all of our programs in this regard. One of the main functions of AHEC is we are sort of the linchpin of the infrastructure that supports outreach activities from the university. As you can imagine, technologies in the last decade in these communities have improved significantly. We've gone from, 36K modems to high-speed internet in almost all of our communities, and we're looking for ways to improve efficiency of delivery of our programs rather than my getting in the car and driving out, looking for ways that we can use technology to be more efficient and cost-effective and to support our students. As we have more and more students off campus, we have to find better ways to stay connected with them, deliver didactic curriculum and other services to them in a dissociated way to ensure quality as well as to make sure that they stay connected to the educational resources that they need to be successful. It's also an essential for accreditation and just other processes to have those in place. And AHEC has kind of taken the central role at assisting the university at the outreach and the technology portion with, of course, other partner campuses.
Dr. Dodson, can I ask you a question about just about that?
Yes.
In terms of online education, how do you measure the quality, and how do you make a decision about what you can and cannot do through video conferencing or mm-hmm. online?
It's a complicated question. The short answer is there are a variety of measures. The nursing school has actually been the lead in this because they've been doing it longer because of the many campuses that they've had. We have accreditation requirements that will certainly address some of that. We have to meet certain standards with our curriculum, and there are several bodies that oversee that. it is a challenge. The quality of delivery, there's sort of the piece of the didactic itself, and then the quality of the delivery system certainly affects the learning opportunities that students have and the quality of it. I wish I could answer your question more specifically. We're still experimenting a great deal, and I don't know the direct answer, and it would probably be a very long one. There are people out there within OHSU and outside who really specialize in this, and again, we're relying a lot on their expertise, and it's certainly not mine.
Chairman Galizio, one way that that's assessed is really through the outcome at the end in terms of the skill sets that the graduate acquires. And in nursing, they're extremely precise in measuring those sort of qualities and clinical skill competencies. And so the test is, are they equivalent or better than those who aren't learning through distance ed? So in a profession where you have competencies as the end result or passage of a licensure exam, it's a little easier to assess than it sometimes is in an undergraduate curriculum, for example. I mean, you can do things like student satisfaction measures as well, and they're of interest and they're relevant, but it's really competency that we usually measure, and that's worked very well in nursing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the physicians that go into rural practice, how many of them are including OB in their practices?
That's a wildly moving target right now. House Bill 3630 that passed and has been providing the medical malpractice reinsurance has been looked at by my department and by the AHEC jointly, and there is a report been developed looking at that exact issue. Right now, the numbers in broadly around Oregon, and I don't know that I can break this out by OHSU graduates or not, they're declining. I'm cutting your math here. They're declining somewhat. I would say that we only have one community that has completely lost obstetrical services since the institution of that measure, and that was Reedsport, Oregon. There's several complicating factors, but one is the declining number of deliveries available because of the decreasing number of younger people living in rural communities, which has actually driven some providers to stop practicing, as well as malpractice costs and lifestyle issues as well. Right now, we believe that there are something on the order of 6 communities in jeopardy of losing obstetrical coverage based on the most recent data that we have. I'm sorry I can't give you an exact number. On one of my previous slides, there was a number of our graduates from the residency programs practicing obstetrics in rural communities. I can go back and get that number if you'd like.
I think that your explanation is adequate.
Okay. In your slide packet, there is that number on those graphs I showed you from the residency graduate data. There is obstetrical numbers on there as well. You can refer back to.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bison.
I thank my colleagues. If you have other questions for either the Dean of Medicine or the Director of the AHEC, this would be a good time, but of course any time is a good time. What I would like to do now is just take a couple of minutes to just kind of clean up in a way, just tell you about a couple more programs that the state funds in the state appropriation to OHSU, but for which we're not asking for additional funds related to workforce or the policy option packages, but just to give you an update of what they do. One is the Office of Rural Health, not to be confused with the AHEC program. The Office of Rural Health has a very similar mission, however, and it is a state Office of Rural Health is a sort of term of art, a national term of art, and those programs around the country serve to assist rural clinics and hospitals primarily in technical ways, sometimes in a workforce manner, with recruitment of healthcare professions, with technical assistance and compliance, and reimbursement structures, in a variety of things that might be putting them in jeopardy for one reason or another. We have a very vigorous Office of Rural Health. It's intentionally housed right next to the AHEC program. There's a lot of overlap and a lot of synergy in those two programs, but the specific tasks related to the Office of Rural Health appropriation are that they assist these clinics and hospitals to essentially keep their doors open. And one of the mechanisms that they use are federal grants that help small hospitals become what are known as critical access hospitals. That creates an eligibility for a better reimbursement structure. And that difference is often the difference between staying in business or not staying in business for a rural hospital. The average, and I'm told by our director, Scott Ekblatt, that 15 is no longer correct. That's probably more like 25 if you brought that slide. That's about a year ago. So that's 25 small hospitals that have now qualified, and they average a gain of about $250,000 a year. That may not sound like a huge number, but for a small rural hospital, that's very significant. We testified at a hearing in Florence during the interim, where the hospital director of the Florence hospital said that the critical access change for them was brought $1 million to their bottom line, which was the difference between being in business and not being in business for them. So that's a major activity of the Office of Rural Health, in addition to a host of other technical forms of assistance. And this gives you a glimpse of how that's done. The pink line is the state appropriation to the Office of Rural Health over time since it was transferred to OHSU really in the 1989 legislature. And the blue line is the federal funding that we've sought and won to assist, particularly in something called the Flex Grant, which is specifically the grant that helps this critical access hospital conversion, but also provides a variety of other forms of assistance. We switched maps on you. I saw many of you looking through puzzled when we turned this up in the AHEC section because we thought this was a little bit clearer. It's also a little bit more up to date, and I apologize for not having put it in your book, but it divides the state into the AHEC regions, which are the dark black lines and the yellow labels. Those are the different parts of the state that are covered by the different centers. But the little blue and red dots represent sites, and you don't have to be able to read them just to know that they're out there and scattered pretty uniformly across the state, are the sites where the Office of Rural Health, in contrast to the AHEC, have provided either recruitment assistance for whatever they need, a physician assistant, a physician, a nurse, or technical assistance, and that's what the TA stands for, and I apologize for not having spelled that out, to those particular clinics or sites. So it just gives you a little bit of a feel for the nature of their work. And I want to touch on one more thing before I finish this section, and that is that over the years, and some of us have been around for a while, we have pulled together in a variety of locations outreach programs, typically not directly funded, that attempt to help develop the pipelines into science and math. And some NSF studies have said that our pipeline in math and science right now is thinner than it was in the Sputnik era. And I don't know if any of you were around then, but I was, and I'll admit. And it was a time when we had a tremendous shortage of young people wanting to go into science and math. And one of the things that changed that dramatically were pipeline-type programs, and that in itself is jargon, but the idea is to provide opportunities for young people to experience the sort of thrill and joy of science and learn that it is a realistic aspiration for them if they stick to business, if they understand that they have to keep taking math even though it's hard, or that they because there's something worthwhile at the other end. And so all of our programs have an aspect of this, but we specifically organized an office a few years ago. They call themselves the Science Education Outreach Office, but what they do is essentially provide a little bit of infrastructure and a coordination, and they've obtained now some federal grants to really bring students from all over the state into programs. And I always put it like this. We have lots of programs where students touch us. They come in the summer, they come for a workshop, but who's watching to see what they do the next summer? Who makes sure that if there's another opportunity that might be just right for them, we pull them along and keep them engaged in those kinds of opportunities and thinking about those as long-term goals? So that we have a lot of things that do that, and I won't belabor that point. What I want to do now is change gears for just a couple of minutes before turning this back over to President Robertson to conclude. And I gave you a packet in front of you that has six slides in it, and they're not in your book in this order. You've seen five of them before, but I thought this would save you from having to flip around. Before I take you to those, though, I have inserted in the book a section on the Oregon Graduate Institute, and I would be happy to share this with you. Goals. So that we have a lot of things that do that, and I won't belabor that point. What I want to do now is change gears for just a couple of minutes before turning this back over to President Robertson to conclude. And I gave you a packet in front of you that has six slides in it, and they're not in your book in this order. You've seen five of them before, but I thought this would save you from having to flip around. Before I take you to those, though, I have inserted in the book a section on the Oregon Graduate Institute, and I would be happy to share this with you. I'm a little worried that we're short of time, and we're not specifically asking for funding for this campus and for this program, but I wanted you to have some information about the wonderful things they're doing, because that program out there has really transformed since the merger, and they still have very strong computer science, engineering, and environmental science, but they've also added biomedical engineering, and all of those programs have begun to focus on health applications and medical applications to their science, computer science and engineering. And I thought some of you might find it interesting to see in there what the specific areas are where those folks have developed. And so I put those in there for your interest, and I'd be happy to answer questions on those. But what I want to do now is simply summarize our policy option packages. And this is the packet that I just gave you. And also under tab 9, you will find this same sheet in slightly larger type, so that might meet the ADA requirement, I'm not sure, more readily. But that first slide is also the first page under tab 9, which describes a little bit more detail the budgets for the policy option packages about which you've been hearing. And so this first page simply summarizes them, and it was mentioned on Monday that we have also provided what they would cost in the subsequent biennium. And we develop typically a five-year business plan when we contemplate starting a new program. And so you can see the spreadsheets, if you like that sort of thing, under tab 9 for each one of these programs. And if you have further questions, there's drill down behind that we'd be happy to provide. But the reason I wanted to remind you that you have this information is that one of the things that I know you have to ask is, what are you going to get for your money? What comes out the other end when you fund one of these packages, in our case, all workforce enhancement packages? We showed you a couple of ways to measure that. In our case, it's healthcare providers that graduate. Now, the state form for performance measures goes out to about 2009. It takes a while to train these folks, so we have taken these graphs out to a sort of steady state of the specific package in the graphs that you saw these on Monday. For the physicians, the blue line represents the decline that would occur without the first option package. We cannot sustain the 120 class size. The red represents that first package. And remember, that package is $4.1 million the first biennium and zero the second biennium, because by then we'll have enough tuition revenue from that class size to sustain it. The green line represents the regionalization program, the ramp in of the regionalization program with first-year students on site in Eugene and Corvallis. The governor's recommended budget shows a staggered package. We submitted two, and you can see that in that first page if you want. If we'd started them both simultaneously, it would have been another $1 million. The $7 million, let me go back to that to show you. The regionalization with the Eugene and Corvallis, the satellite programs, to do them both simultaneously is $7.09 million. If you look in the footnote, and I apologize, you might need a magnifying glass for that, the footnote shows what happens if we stagger and start the Corvallis program a year behind the Eugene program, and that's what's in the governor's recommended budget. It's $6 million. The second year, it's actually a little more, just because of the way you have to ramp up the teaching. In nursing, we do have actually, as Mr. Bender suspects, a response to that employment division. Both the Oregon Center for Nursing and the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute have responses that disagree rather sharply with that conclusion, so I'll provide those subsequently to the committee. These are, in fact, the what would be produced by the various nursing packages that you heard discussed from Dean Tice on Tuesday, and this is the increase in teachers, nurse educators, and I will just add one comment subsequent to our testimony on Tuesday, partly because of the questions and some of the discussion. I have begun to talk to the people who are involved in the scholarship packages and the loan repayment packages, and at least there's initial interest, in fact, even enthusiasm in considering adding nurse educators to some of those in the rural areas. The numbers would not be very large, so there shouldn't be a very large fiscal impact, but making them eligible for some loan repayment may turn out to be a very nice kind of incentive and assistance, and the money's already in the requested budget, so it shouldn't be, it's a reallocation to a different purpose slightly, but it's not a large effect. And we'll bring you back some details and see what you think and what others think where that is heard. What I wanted to show you is two last slides. This one you saw before, and it elicited a number of questions and discussion from Representative Edwards and some discussions afterwards with Senators Deckard and Morris, and it prompted us to think of something, and I want to share it with you because we were quite astounded and excited to see it. This shows, as we discussed, the decline in state revenue over the years and the increased leverage that we've been able to obtain both with our own missions and with partners in increasing our enrollment in medicine, dentistry, and nursing. We wondered, after that discussion on Monday, what would happen if you projected out and added the policy option packages. And we, to do that, we took this same slide that we've been looking at, and we took the 2009-11 data from our business plans and assumed that each of those that the governor recommended in his budget was funded in the second biennium. And then we took the base budget and added 3.1%, the exact calculation that went into this year's biennium. And then we projected out for the next three biennium. And the graph looks like this. To the left of that yellow bar is what you just saw in the previous graph. It's all the same data. And what we did is that we added, if the governor's recommended budget were completely funded, as you've been hearing, then the appropriation for OHSU would be $94.2 million for the biennium. That is still less than the 2001-2003 biennium. And if you look at that second biennium, the next biennium out, 2009-2011, in fact, there's very little change. And in part, that's because that package number one for the School of Medicine, that $4 million package, goes away, and it essentially offsets the ramping up of the rest of the programs and the 3.1%. So at the stage of 2009-11, you would be still less than 2001-2003 appropriation, and then I just took 3.1% for that last biennium. So at the end of that time, you would have ramped in the enrollment increases from all the policy option packages. And we looked at this graph and we're just shocked. That blue dotted line is the enrollment that results from the policy option package implementation, and it's showing in green is the investment that it takes to generate that production of healthcare providers. And it to an educator, this looks like some kind of magic. It may not to you, but it's really a phenomenon of leverage. It's leveraging on the margin the existing capacity that we have at OHSU, but adding to that the capacity of partners who are willing to share in the, particularly the clinical mentoring of these healthcare professional students. So that's just a graphic, but I think it illustrates what we've been trying to tell you. So I'd be happy to take any questions on this. What I'd like to do is turn the when those are answered, is turn it back to President Robertson to give you a glimpse of the future. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question with respect to the nursing program, and would invite you to comment on the citation that Mr. Bender made of the Employment Department Work Source study, because it's suggestive that actually there would be a surplus, I believe, if I add those numbers of nursing in the state, given the pipeline that exists with other institutions.
Representative Galizia, Chairman Galizia, and Senator Morris, there's a very long answer to that, but the short, and we have it in a paper, and I'll provide that to you, but the short answer is that looks at one kind of nurse. It does not distinguish between the nursing needs across the spectrum of nursing, including advanced practice, and including nursing homes and community-based. Now, it's an employer survey, and it is a very good analysis of what they receive back from the employers, but the assessment argument that has been made around the country, and specifically in Oregon, is that it does not take into account the different kinds of nurses and the shortages that hospitals are experiencing. If you look at the data, one of the things that's happening is that employers are filling those vacancies with travelers, they're called, and that is an extremely expensive way to staff nursing in the hospitals. So it isn't technically a vacancy because they have, in fact, someone in that position, but it's still it's not a viable way to operate the healthcare system in which they've recruited these travelers to fill these holes. So we aren't there's a very long kind of, we can break out the capacity, but some of it has to do with the educational level of the nurse and whether they're filling the need, and that's why the emphasis on baccalaureate prepared nurses. But some of it is the need for advanced practice nurses. Some is the shortage of teachers. But what I'd like to do is bring back that report, and I can bring it back on Monday and give it to you as part of the public testimony, and you'll be able to see the breakdown, and it also gives some distribution as well.
Thank you.
Would that be helpful?
If you have the data available to you, the percentage of the nursing workforce that are travelers,
I don't know if I do, but I mean, I certainly do for our own hospital, and I have it from some systems, but I don't know that it's comprehensive, but I'll check and see what there is available.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Howell, just to emphasize that a little bit more, the more that you can get us, the better, and it's not actually just for this issue before us. There are issues relative to community colleges. There are, I believe, more than one nursing shortages bills circulating around the building. There are a number of issues in workforce development. There's just so much that we need to get some more clarity on this issue so that we can maybe have a chance of making the right decision.
Representative, I'm sorry, Senator Dell and Chair Galizio, we will certainly bring you that back. As I think you know, there are some coordinated packages as well, and they will be coming forward. One is in OUS, which is the pre-nursing curriculum, the science, the chemistry, the biology, to make sure they can adequately prepare students. And the community colleges have a facilities component to some of theirs.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Richardson and Dr. Dodson. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Galizio, members of the committee, it is my privilege to give you the summation, and I will attempt to do so in the 7-minute version. And I also, before I begin that, I want to thank you for your attentiveness, your persistence, and your patience over the past several days, and your willingness to delve into all these details with us. We really can't help ourselves. We come from this teaching and academic background, and we tend to put a lot of information on the slide. So thank you very much. What I want to do is just briefly say where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. And there's a long history of growth at OHSU, and we don't have time to go over that proud history now. Most notably, of course, was when we became a public corporation that did enable us to do the things that I think have led to the financial stability and viability that allowed us to have some of the performance that is so noted on and just stands out when you see the comparison with the other schools in the Western region. And really, over the past decade, what really has happened is OHSU has grown up as an academic health center. We have maintained that momentum during the past year. We have brought 1 million square feet of space on board, and we have done that in a way where those buildings did come online, on time, on budget. With not only a marked increase in the academic arena, but also I think a marked impact for the economic impact for the region, and we have seen in the various presentations where those are, and I think I will not go over all those now either, except to make a comment about the Oregon opportunity, as I didn't realize this was going to come part by part in the Oregon opportunity that I think you've seen over the past few days already the return on that investment, and there was a recent article this past year in the Harvard Business Review that says the product life cycle, the product development cycle, rather, for something in bioscience is not analogous to that in, quote, the conventional high tech, where it's 6 months, it's 17 years. So this is an investment in which we are just beginning to see the fruits of that labor and that investment. So we will look for that, and our children will see the benefit of that. And I think now is the time to do the same thing in the educational arena. You know, we are meeting that need in the scientific arena. We see this overwhelming case in the healthcare workforce, and I think it's time to make a similar investment. I'm going to leave this slide up there for a while I do provide sort of a summary of the justification for our policy option packages, because I hope we will all imprint on this, because as you walk away from here, you really will see that OHSU is committed to working at this interface, committed to leveraging it's at the interface where we get this opportunity to make the discoveries. And it also is symbolic of something that's very important to us, and that is the ability to partner. As we look toward our request, we would like to emphasize the fact that we are good stewards. We're very proud of our performance, and we've of course demonstrated that with various slides and figures that we think that we've shown you. But as you go around the country and you compare, we really are in each instance, if not the best of class, certainly among the best of class. And the numbers on that chart that you saw are very real numbers. Now, the numbers for some of those schools per student clearly exceed the cost of educating per student. Okay, but that is money that then is still invested in the academic enterprise. At OHSU, we have to find those funds elsewhere. And our situational analysis is such that, yes, we're efficient, but we also recruit those dollars, and we do so through philanthropic causes, and we do that through diversion of revenue from our clinical enterprise. But there is a limit to how far we can do that, and a limit to how far we can leverage ourselves. We have gained recognition. There will be an article coming out soon in the major journal of academic medicine about what's happening in Oregon and about the regionalization plan that we have presented. It will be a major article in what we call the Blue Journal. There is also, within about 10 days, there will be a team visiting OHSU from the American Association Medical College just to see just how this magic is being created, because they are contrasting what's happening here with what's happening in other states, and they are coming here to find out how we do it the Oregon way. So there are more than just our facts and figures. There are tales from elsewhere and comparable data, I think, to demonstrate our stewardship. Our policy option packages, in summary, have all been directed toward workforce. We are a large and diverse organization. We have many other interests. There are many competing interests. There are many things that we could have asked you for. There are many things that people came to me and wanted to make sure that we were asking you for. But we think overwhelmingly that the public policy issue here of major importance is workforce, and that's why there is a laser-like focus with our request. As we look to the future, we think that we will make the commitment to you to leverage the resources in the best possible manner. You can see that as we've moved through these past several bienniums, despite having had our budget cut, we have continued to train more students. We have worked with others. If you look at the actual dollar flow in our policy option packages and you track it to the end consumer of the dollar, many of those people will not be on Markham Hill. It will be in a distributed manner around this state. So this is not a Markham Hill specific request. This is a request that I think is doing the most with the least. And finally, I'd like to end on a very positive note. I want to say a little bit about our South Waterfront and our Snitzer campus. As you know, the tram is more than just a means of transportation. It is actually the vital link that creates one campus out of two parcels of land. There's been marked development on part of it already. I'll come back to this slide. And we pulled these out of the archives. It's been a brownfield for almost a century, and now it's becoming an oasis of learning. We have four blocks, as you will see here, to the south of the tram, and we will the brown area, this slide is so recent, so much has happened so quickly. The brown area to the north of that development is the Snitzer campus. That's 20 acres of land that was donated by the Snitzer family, where we will ultimately have the opportunity through what will hopefully be a public-private partnership to develop a new interdisciplinary transprofessional educational campus. The slide that I skipped over that looked a bit like Sputnik or a space station with all the circles connected, that is supposed to demonstrate is that this will be a new model of education. It will be one where students will have shared experiences. Our learners of different types will sit side by side. So at the end of their training, when we ask them to work together, they will have had the experience of learning together. All of the outcomes data tells you that superb outcomes are dependent upon communication and working together. We will build an environment that embodies our ideals. And nobody else has had the opportunity to do that. 20 acres just doesn't come up available to give you the opportunity to start over in an urban area. So this is also sort of giving you a glimpse of the future. We are realistic. We are pragmatists to the packages that we have put before you. For this year are those that we think we need to make a marked and sort of dent in this problem to get us off to a good start. They will not be sufficient to solve the problem, and I think in subsequent years, now that we have a $40 million anonymous gift that was given just about 2 to 3 weeks ago that will allow us to begin to start planning this campus in the future, we will come back and hopefully describe that and hopefully garner some support which we can take to the philanthropic community to leverage for a very worthwhile investment for the state. This is just a schematic. This is not what this is going to actually look like, but we do like to end on a very bright note and talk about the way that our dream will become a reality. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any quick questions or comments? Well, Dr. Halleck and Dr. Robson, thank you very much. Very impressive. You set the bar quite high, and we look forward to the public testimony on Monday. And thank you all very much to everyone who testified today and then the previous day. So
thank
with
you.
That, we'll adjourn the public hearing, and we are adjourned. Thank you.